And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to be with us on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. We have made it halfway through the week. Now that we are just past the noon hour here on a Wednesday over the hump day. And boy, the remaining days of October are dwindling down to a precious few. We have about a week left in October. Last day of October, Halloween. It's a week from tomorrow. Yeah. Be a lot of Halloween parties this weekend, I would suspect, because by the time we get to the next weekend, you know, Halloween will be over. Old hat. So Halloween parties, they've become pretty big these days. So look out for those if you're out driving around this Friday or Saturday. I suspect there'll be quite a bit of partying going on. Seems like adults enjoy Halloween more than kids do these days. Good program for you today. We'll tell you what's coming up in just a moment or so. Have you noticed the fall foliage? It's getting a little bit more colorful. I've been outside the city the past couple of days, past 3 days actually, and went north a couple of times, and it's amazing. If you just go from Butler up to Slippery Rock, Harrisville, Grove City, it's a little bit different. They're a little bit further ahead in terms of the leaf color. Don't have to go too much further north. And, of course, if you're talking about New England and parts of north central Pennsylvania, they're really already past the peak color. It seems to me I'm seeing more color now, but it's muted. You know, it's not, for the most part, it's not a brilliant color. And weather folks told us that a few weeks back, that it was probably going to be a little bit of a dull autumn in terms of color. Now, many trees are still green, but they're dull green. You know, you can tell they're on the way out fast. I've seen a couple of spectacular trees. I think the prettiest ones are the red-orange. And you get a day like today with brilliant sunshine, and those red-orange trees just stand out like crazy. They are gorgeous. Some trees are already losing their leaves. We have a couple of trees that border our parking lot here at WISR, and they are rapidly losing all of their leaves. They're maple trees, some variety of maple. And as soon as they start to lose their green and change, they get sort of a russet orange color. They lose their leaves within just a couple of days. It's amazing. They turn and bingo, they're gone. And we've had some rain yesterday, of course. Not today. We have pretty gusty winds. And those trees are nearly bare already. So I don't know whether we're really going to have a spectacular fall foliage here in our area this year or not. I'm beginning to think probably not. Well, we'll see. I don't think we're quite to the peak yet. But you get a sunny day like today, if you have few extra minutes, take a drive around and enjoy some of the fall color, because probably not going to get a whole lot better. We are going to be talking today, first of all, about flu shots. This is the time of the year when all of the experts are recommending that we get flu shots. And why is it so important? Well, we will talk about that with a physician. She is Dr. Milan Hahn, who is with the American Lung Association. And she'll be joining us by telephone very shortly here. We'll talk about the importance of getting a flu shot. Also on the program today, this year marks the 500th anniversary of the death of Leonardo da Vinci. And I don't know whether you know much about Leonardo. He was truly a Renaissance man. I mean, He did practically everything. He was like the Thomas Edison of his day. I mean, the guy was an architect, he was an inventor, he was a thinker, he was an artist, obviously, a great artist. Well, we'll talk with a couple of individuals a little bit later on the program who have a profile of Leonardo da Vinci on the 500th anniversary of his passing. Jean-Pierre Espouts and Dr. Christopher Brown will be joining us. So I think you'll find that interesting. And then a great story, a World War II era story called Storm Over Paris. And it centers on the theft of paintings from Europe by the Nazi regime, including some of the real bigwigs in the Nazi regime, like Hermann Göring and others. This happened, and it happened a lot. And in many cases, they're still trying to get the stolen paintings and the stolen art back to where they belong. So it's a good story about art theft in the World War II era. And we'll be chatting about that with author William Grubman a little bit later on the program. So we have a lot of ground to cover here. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be talking about flu shots. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. And this month of October, they're marking the 16th anniversary of the opening of their Salvation Army, of their Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in the greater Butler Mart, Route 8 just south of Butler. Yeah, 16 years they've been there already. Their old location was on Elm Street in the city. And here's the important thing to remember. All of the revenue generated through the operation of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul thrift store stays right here in Butler County to help support the Society of St. Vincent de Paul food bank and their client aid program. So as they mark the 16th anniversary, they'd like to send out a special thank you to all the folks, all the organizations, all the businesses, all the donors, all the churches, and all of the thrift store customers for their support and generous contributions, helping the folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul make a better life for so many people, so many less fortunate families here in the Butler area. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store, Greater Butler Mart, we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Coming up, listeners, on this segment of It's Your Turn on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. We're going to talk about flu shots and why they are so important. And we have with us via the telephone today our special guest, Dr. Milan Hahn, who is a top expert with the American Lung Association. Dr. Hahn, flu season is here, right? Don't wait any longer to get your flu shot.
Absolutely. October is the month that the CDC recommends people get their flu shot. Unfortunately, we've already seen cases of flu. We've had a few deaths from the flu, so now is the time for people to be thinking about this.
Who especially should get a flu shot this year?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control recommends that everyone over the age of 6 months get a flu vaccine. However, there are certain groups of patients that are really going to be at increased risk, and that includes young children, pregnant women, and individuals over 50. Individuals over 50 are particularly at increased risk because the immune system wanes, and many individuals over 50 also have chronic conditions, lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, that sort of thing, that's going to make complications from the flu much, much, much more severe. So those are the groups we're really trying to target.
And that can cause serious illness. These chronic medical conditions can become much worse. In fact, last year, this is an amazing statistic, close to 50,000 Americans lost their lives due to flu-related complications. Wow.
Yeah, I think this is something that people just don't realize, right? They think, oh, I had a virus, I probably had the flu, and it was fine. What people don't realize is that true influenza can absolutely be deadly. I've witnessed patients in the ICU fighting for their lives. This is not something to fool around with, and that's why, I get pushback every year from my patients about getting the flu shot. I think there's a lot of myths out there. One of them is that you get the flu from the flu shot, and that's one that I'd really like to dispel. It's not a live vaccine. So, you may feel perhaps a little bit off for a few days, but it's nothing. Those symptoms are truly nothing compared to true influenza.
Well, I've gotten my flu shot already, and, you know.
Good for you.
Hurts for a couple of seconds, and then, you know, that's the end of that. But, folks, you cannot get the flu by getting a flu shot. Wherever that myth came from, I don't know, but it's impossible. A flu shot will not make you sick. In fact, it might save your life. We hear sometimes, Dr. Hahn, in fact, I think last year I saw some wire reports that maybe the flu shot wasn't as effective as folks thought it was going to be. People hear this and then they say, well, you know, why should I get one? Can you talk about that for a moment or so?
Yeah, you know, I liken it a bit to this. If you know you were going to be running through, let's say, a field where bullets were being shot at you, would you rather run through the field or would you rather run through it with a protective vest on? And it's a bit like that. It is really the only protection that we have for people, and I would say that some protection is better than no protection. So it's true every year there's a little bit of difference in terms of the vaccine strain mix and whether that completely matches the strains that are going around, but it will provide some protection. And for, you know, again, many of our patients who are quite ill, it's really the best protection that we can provide for them.
It's amazing.
You know, one thing that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's amazing that so many people don't realize how serious flu can be. Last year in the United States, 500,000 people were hospitalized for flu, and as you mentioned, close to 50,000 died. I think one of the problems is a lot of people mistake and mix up a flu and the common cold. They're two different animals, are they not, Dr. Hahn?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of viruses that we have that can cause upper respiratory symptoms, but true influenza often can actually go into the lungs and develop into pneumonia and can be incredibly serious. I think one of the things, you know, we were talking a little bit about the pushback that we get from people about, or that I get from people about the shot. And one thing I would love to just tell your listeners there in Butler is that even if they think that they're immune, that they've never had the flu, they don't know anybody who's had the flu, you know, they get viruses every year, but they're fine, they may have a loved one that's in that increased risk group. So that, again, includes young children, pregnant women, and older adults over 50 or those with chronic medical conditions. And if they have a loved one, then I would argue if you're not going to get the shot for yourself, to get it for the loved one, because the more people that we have in a community that are vaccinated, the lower the overall risk of anyone getting the flu. So I actually almost view it as a civic responsibility.
It amazes me that people don't get a flu shot. I mean, in many cases, you can get them free at clinics or, you know, they're covered by insurance or Medicare. I mean, I can't imagine why someone would not get one, for goodness sakes.
I think a lot of times people get busy and they kind of mentally put it on their list, but, you know, they've got other errands to run and then it just kind of falls down. I have to tell you, I have a 6-year-old son, and I make sure he gets his flu shot even before I get mine, and I'm a doctor, so I have to get it at work. It is that important for me that I've got it on the calendar every fall. It's something I will not let fall through the cracks for my child. And that's why I'm really imploring, you know, parents and adults, obviously, to think about it. It's got to get on your calendar, just like women get a mammogram every year. Flu shot needs to just be one of those things that you just do.
I didn't realize that you had a young son. I've seen stories the past couple of years about some sort of a nasal thing for kids that they can get a flu vaccine in their nose, but then I've seen reports that that's not so effective. Have you heard anything about that, Dr. Hahn?
Well, there are actually a lot of different vaccine formulations available out there that are developed for specific subgroups of the patient population. There's some that are more specifically designed for younger individuals and some that are more specifically designed for older individuals. What I would say is that people should get in and talk to their healthcare provider about which vaccine would be best for them and the pros and cons of the individual formulations. And again, if people have questions, questions about where to get vaccines and potentially talk to someone more about this further, they can go to the website, getmyshot.org, for more information.
It's easy to remember, getmyshot.org, get your flu shot.
Absolutely. Get it on the calendar.
Dr. Mila Nahan, visiting with us, a top expert with the American Lung Association. Thanks, Doctor. Good to talk with you today. Thanks much.
Thanks so much, Dave.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Do you have a discount card at your favorite food store to get special savings? Compassionate Certification Center is here to get you a medical marijuana card. Because with a medical card, prices are half what you'd pay elsewhere. Don't get stuck paying double for your medical or recreational marijuana. Recreational states charge double if you are not a medical patient. Be ahead of the game. Visit cccregister.com and in three easy steps, get your card. cccregister.com or call 888-316-9085.
Listeners, I think you're going to be intrigued on our next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm certainly looking forward to talking to our two guests. They both join us by telephone here today, Jean-Pierre Ispoutz and Dr. Christopher Brown. We're going to be talking about Leonardo da Vinci. First of all, gentlemen, thanks for being with us here today. I'm anxious to talk to you.
Thanks for having us.
This is a significant year when we're talking about Leonardo da Vinci. It's the 500th anniversary of his death, and you've written an illustrated book that is available. Can you tell us a little bit, Jean-Pierre, about the book?
Sure. It's what struck us as we thought about writing this book, the Da Vinci Legacy, is that when Leonardo died, he was really a forgotten artist. He went to exile in France. He died as a recluse in Italy. His fame was long overshadowed by Raphael and Michelangelo. And yet today, he's the most famous artist. His work, the Salvator Mundi, just sold for $500 million. So we were asking ourselves, what the heck happened? How could someone who was all but forgotten 500 years ago become so famous? And that's the arc that we're trying to trace in this book.
Dr. Brown, I knew a little bit about Leonardo da Vinci. I had no idea that he died as almost a recluse, right?
Well, that's correct. For the last 3 years of his life, Leonardo lived with the French king, and records have it that they would meet every day, and they would talk, and they would chat, and the very last three paintings that Leonardo had with him at that period of time were then accepted by the French king, or perhaps the French king paid for them, although we can't find a receipt for the payment per se. Those three paintings were the Mona Lisa, and Saint Anne, the Virgin and Child, and John the Baptist. And the French king was really trying to bring a cultural change with art into France at that period of time, and was just fascinated by not only Leonardo's art, but all his writings and his notebooks about science and nature and his observation and engineering and war machines. So even though Leonardo was probably one of the most brilliant human beings in the world, I think the French king realized that. But at the same point, nobody else really knew, just the French king and Leonardo at the end.
By the way, Dr. Brown, is that how the Mona Lisa ended up at the Louvre in Paris, or no?
Yeah, correct. That's exactly how it ended up there. There are some records and some misunderstandings about potentially another Mona Lisa painting in the possession of Sally, but we believe that to be a copy and not this painting. And more likely than not, the Louvre Mona Lisa has never left Paris since it was taken there.
Probably the most famous painting in the world. Just about everybody has heard of it. I was somewhat surprised when I saw it in person about the size of it. I thought it would be much bigger. It's actually a rather small painting, is it not?
It's a very small painting, and what our book shows is that there are actually two Mona Lisas that Leonardo painted. This may come as a shock to your listeners, but we found that there was a earlier Mona Lisa, a first version of the Mona Lisa, which is actually a portrait, a likeness of this beautiful young woman. She was 23 years at the time, Lisa del Giocondo, wife of a Florentine silk merchant. And then 10 years later, Leonardo decided to return to the theme, using his drawings and sketches of Lisa, but to create something very, very different. And that is the second portrait, which now hangs in the Louvre.
Wow. Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit about these multispectral scans that you were doing of a copy of The Last Supper. What was that all about?
Actually, I'm going to let Jean-Pierre answer this one because he's been recently working with some pretty amazing technology. And Jean-Pierre, why don't you answer this one?
Sure. Chris Brown and I found out that there, just like Leonardo painted a second version of the Mona Lisa, he also painted a second version of The Last Supper. And that's great because if your listeners have been to Milan and seen the original fresco of The Last Supper, they will have seen that the fresco is terribly decayed. Only some 20% is still visible of that original painting because Leonardo experimented with his pigments and it didn't stick to the wall. So the second version, which we found in a monastery in Belgium, is in fact the second version of The Last Supper, painted by Leonardo's workshop under his direction. And Chris and I sort of felt that the two figures in this painting, Christ as well as John the Apostle, really felt like this was painted by Leonardo himself, not by his pupils. And so we conducted a multispectral study, and we found, without a doubt, that certainly the figure of John was painted by Leonardo himself. Multispectral technology allows you to see things that the human eye does not see. You really look underneath the paint layer, and you can see fascinating things.
Hmm. I was not aware that there was a copy of The Last Supper. Is it pretty much the same as the original fresco?
Yeah, it's almost to scale. It's huge, and it's been in this monastery, which is why not many people know about it. But when we announced the results of the study just a month ago, we had lots of TV networks and national papers throughout Europe attending it. But now we're bringing this news for the first time to an American audience.
And I'd like to add that, you know, part of the reason that this is such a significant finding is, again, in Milan, The Last Supper is only 20% of what Leonardo painted is there. This canvas, although it has a little damage, is almost like it was painted yesterday. And it's in the same scale. The same cartoons were used to paint all the other apostles, with the exception of the Christ and John position. So we were able to take this canvas and in a 3D manner place it back into Milan with the windows and the interplay of light and of the light and the sun coming through the windows. And you get a beautiful three-dimensional feel of what The Last Supper would have looked like in the 1500s.
And the original was a fresco. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with that term and how it differs from a painting. Can either one of you address that?
Sure. A fresco is painted on a wet plaster wall. So what you do is you cover the wall with wet plaster to make it very smooth, and then you use tempera paint, which is paint based on egg yolk, which dries very, very quickly and then bonds with the wall, so it stays there for many centuries. But Leonardo didn't like tempera paint. He wanted to use oils because it was with oils that he created these beautiful three-dimensional effects of light and tone and shade of his beautiful portraits in the Milan period. So he wanted to do the same thing. He could not bring himself to use tempera paint, and as a result, well, he used oils, and oils on a wet wall doesn't work. What's more, the wall was adjoining the kitchen because it was painted in the refectory where the monks come together and have meals. So obviously there was a lot of moisture seeping through the wall from the adjoining kitchen, and that also added to the destruction of the fresco.
We're talking, listeners, here on the It's Your Turn program today with Jean-Pierre Isbouts and Dr. Christopher Brown. They are the co-authors of a new illustrated book, The Da Vinci Legacy. And I understand, Dr. Brown, that there's also a PBS TV special based on your book. Has that aired already, or is that still to come?
Yes, it has aired, but over the next 3 months, I think it'll be on all the viewing areas. Morgan Freeman actually did the narration or the voiceover for the movie, which is called Search for the Mona Lisa. And this is actually our second broadcast on PBS. The first one was called Search for the Last Supper, which is what we were just speaking about, the Last Supper painting that's in the Belgian monastery. We really enjoyed working with Morgan Freeman on this, and we basically, this is tied into our new book, The Da Vinci Legacy, of course, and really, you know, discusses a lot of the relationship between the earlier Mona Lisa and the Louvre Mona Lisa, and again, then into, you know, why Leonardo da Vinci, even today, is still a pop icon, or why he's so famous even 500 years later.
Jean-Pierre, are we pretty sure of the portrait of the Mona Lisa in terms of who it is a portrait of in real life?
Well, as it happened, this earlier Mona Lisa that Chris is referring to, the first version of the Mona Lisa, has been in vaults for the last century or so, and it just went on public exhibit for the first time in Florence, Italy, the city of her birth, of course. That's where the Mona Lisa came from. And I was there. There was a press conference, unfortunately only for Italian media. But we trust that the news of this great exhibit will travel and that people will go and see it, because, you know, Chris and I were just blown away when we saw this earlier version of the Mona Lisa for the first time. Here's a really beautiful young woman, whereas in the Louvre, you're looking at a much older matronly figure, and it's covered with this dark hue that makes it very difficult to see what's going on. The early Mona Lisa is radically different, and it's just a gorgeous piece.
We've been concentrating on Leonardo da Vinci as a painter and his fresco, of course. But Dr. Brown, my goodness, he was so many other things, including a tremendous inventor. And even though some of his inventions didn't come to fruition, the drawings of them came later. I'm thinking, for example, of a helicopter. Didn't he have early drawings of what we now know as helicopters?
Yes, a helicopter and parachutes. And, you know, Leonardo da Vinci is probably one of the most brilliant human beings that's ever lived. And part of this reason that he's such the Renaissance man is he was one of the first people to observe nature and then apply nature into scientific type of research. And again, he studied the birds, and the birds then related to flying machines and parachutes and other type of contraptions. It's not well known, but Leonardo da Vinci basically in the 1500s and also invented steam or steam locomotion. And that was the beginning of the industrial age. That would happen, some 300 years later. So this you know, man is absolutely brilliant. He also built a tank, for example, and he was so smart that he was worried that if somebody was to find his plans of his tank, that they might use it against the people that he was selling the drawings to. So he put errors in there so that if they built the tank, it wouldn't work. And in fact, when people first built his tank, they couldn't get it to work until they fixed several of the errors that he had purposely put into his drawings.
Amazing. Are his drawings and notebooks and sketchbooks well preserved, Doctor?
Actually, they are pretty well preserved. Bill Gates, several years ago, bought 8 pages of a codex, and I think he paid $35 million, so that's basically $4 to $5 million per page. I believe we only think that there's about 30% of his notebooks that are available in the world. 70% are probably in Swiss bank vaults or lost or have been broken up and sold as separate pages throughout the years. There's probably a lot more information out there that we would love to see, because, again, this man was ingenious.
A couple of more questions for our guests, co-authors of the illustrated book, The Da Vinci Legacy. Jean-Pierre, were you able to talk a little bit about his life? For example, as a child, when did he learn to paint? Did he go to school somewhere?
Well, that's actually a beautiful story, or also a bit of a tragic story, because Leonardo was a natural child, which means that he was the outcome of a fling, of a late summer night fling, between a very promising young notary, Sir Piero, and a very beautiful farm maid. And of course, there was no question that the two could marry. I mean, in those days, the social gulf was too large. So Serpiero went off and married somebody else. And Caterina, his mother, also married someone, a bricklayer. And after 5 years, the bricklayer decided that young Leonardo would have to leave because he had just too many mouths to feed. And so Leonardo was taken away from his mother when he was 5 years old, which is a very traumatic experience for a young child. And I think that haunted him throughout his life. And that's one of the reasons why he always had a very ambivalent attitude towards women. He saw them as mothers, as the mothers he never knew. And that's what's reflected in his beautiful Madonna paintings that he painted in the workshop of Andrea del Verrocchio, a very successful painter, where he did receive an education, not as much of an education he would have had he been the legitimate son of a notary. But, you know, he learned to write, he learned to create paints, to mix pigments and prepare panels and so forth. So he had a bit of an education. But for the rest of his life, he tried to self-educate him to the level where he thought that an artist ought to be.
Dr. Brown, in the last few years of his life, Leonardo da Vinci lived in Rome, where both Michelangelo and Raphael were active at the time. Any evidence that he ever met either of those or talked to them?
We're actually sure that they, you know, that their paths crossed. Unfortunately for Leonardo at that time, the Pope and his court gave him very little credibility or very little type of works to work upon. We believe that's a period of time that he may have been looking into doing anatomical drawings of, for example, a woman pregnant with a child or a fetus or human anatomy such as the heart and heart disease. We're sure there's circles path, but there was probably no type of works that they ever worked on together. Michelangelo and especially Raphael were put up on a pedestal, and that was part of the reason why Leonardo left in 1516, 3 years before his death, and moved to France to live with the French king.
Well, no knock on Michelangelo or Raphael, obviously great artists, but, you know, if you look at the overall body of work, my goodness, there's hardly a match to be found for Leonardo da Vinci, right? Wow.
I would definitely agree with that. And, you know, at that point, Leonardo was an older gentleman, and the artists were in favor, and especially the ones that were involved in sculpture. And I believe that probably did bother Leonardo. But at the same point, Leonardo had somewhat of a reputation for sometimes not finishing his works. And, you know, the Pope and some of the others didn't want to put, you know, the monies towards an artist who might not finish their work or who was near the end of their artistic period of time. What is amazing, though, is we believe that some of Leonardo's most important works were done in those last 6 years of his life, such as Madonna and the Yarnwinder, the Louvre Mona Lisa, the Saint Anne, the Virgin and Child, and, of course, his last painting, John the Baptist. Some of these are his most beautiful paintings and really show the skill level of the artist.
One final question, Jean-Pierre. You have lots of illustrations in your book, The Da Vinci Legacy, right?
We have. We have over 120 beautiful color illustrations, and the publisher, Apollo, did a beautiful job. So it's really a color illustrated book throughout. And in fact, if your listeners would like to get a little preview, they should go to the website, Leonardo Books, that's plural, leonardobooks.com, and they'll get a beautiful preview of the book and its illustrations, and a little preview as well of the documentary with Morgan Freeman that's currently airing on public television.
Co-author.
And there's also links for them to consider purchasing The Da Vinci Legacy on Amazon, which makes it very simple.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Brown. Co-authors of The Da Vinci Legacy, Jean-Pierre Isbouts and Dr. Christopher Brown. Thanks, gentlemen. Great to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Sure. So long now.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there stops here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do.
Hop the bus.
Leave
leave the driving up to us.
The bus. We're going your way.
Tobacco for Less is Western PA's largest glass emporium, and they now have a store in Butler at Pullman Square Plaza. What makes Tobacco for Less different from other stores? For starters, they have so many glass pipes to choose from. They also feature a walk-in humidor and a vape juice bar. And of course, they carry a variety of standard tobacco products too. The Tobacco for Less Health and Wellness Department stocks a large selection of high-quality CBD products. For all your smoking and vaping needs, check out Tobacco for Less with locations in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Boy, a fascinating story. Listeners, coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is William Grubman, author of The Storm Over Paris, and he joins us by telephone today. William Grubman, nice to make your acquaintance. I'm anxious to chat with you.
And you as well. Thank you very much for having me.
The Storm Over Paris. Folks, most people, I think, know about the Nazis and how they would steal art and other valuables from the citizens of Europe, particularly Jewish people, during World War II. But here's the premise of this story. What if a Jewish art dealer turned the tables on Hitler's regime and risked everything he knew to recover some of the famous paintings for safekeeping? And that's, in a nutshell, the theme of your book, right, William?
It is. It certainly is.
Now, first of all, the Nazis really did steal a lot of art and valuable paintings, did they not?
A great deal of art, yes. Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands of paintings and sculptures.
I've even heard that in some cases they stored them in caves, secret caves around Europe. Have you run into that, sir?
That is correct. They stored them everywhere in several countries.
Mm-hmm. Was much of the art and valuables stolen from Jewish people who were then being deported to concentration camps and death camps?
Well, it was a combination of things. It was a combination. It was art in general. Hitler's goal was to build a museum in Austria, a combination museum, parade grounds, hotel, concert venue, etc., and he wanted to stock it with the best art he could get. That art was going to have to come from somewhere, and it was going to be cheaper if they just stole it.
Mm-hmm. Your book is, I think we could categorize it as historical fiction, correct? I mean, it really happened,
it is,
after
it's
all.
It's historical fiction, and I wrote it as a thriller.
How did the Nazis find this art and steal it? I assume they had regular soldiers, right, who went into homes and just took the stuff?
Exactly. And art is very well known. Good art has provenance. Provenance gives us a listing of the artists and where their art is located. Even today, we know where every major painting is in the world, what collection they're in. So Hitler had access to this information, and certainly with the help of people from museums, etc., they could pinpoint who has what, and they literally went in and took it.
How did this happen? I assume in several countries, and probably in any country that the Nazis had occupied, I guess, huh?
That's correct. It's, you know, we always hear the expression, the spoils of war, and this was one of them for Hitler. This was what he was going to do. He was going to loot the world of the finest artwork possible. For a while, he did.
Let's talk a little bit about the basic plot of your book. Your main character is a Jewish art dealer by the name of Maury Rothstein, correct?
Correct.
And what does he decide to do, William?
Well, Maury's enlisted by Hermann Göring, who is one of Hitler's top guys, who was stationed between Germany and, he found himself in Italy too, and a lot of time in France. And Hermann Göring was also very interested in art. That was sort of his passion. And he was a great collector. And it was his job to help oversee what was going to be taken from France. And he enlists the help, I'm using that term loosely, from Maury Rothstein. Basically, he told Maury, you're going to be working for the Nazis now. And there's two choices here. He'll either go to work for the Nazis, or he'll wind up in a prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
And Maury has no choice but to accommodate their requests, which he does.
Maury Rothstein himself, obviously an expert in some of the master paintings and the great artwork of Europe, I guess.
Maury is one of the most well-known experts in the world.
Mm-hmm. How does he
he comes with credentials.
How does he decide to flip and turn the tables?
It was a slow decision, but a painting showed up in Maury's gallery. And it was a painting from somebody that he was very, very close friends with, a painting he had sold the man. And that's when he decided, could he actually get away with stealing this art if it was possible to replace it with a forgery? And that's where we enter Maury's son, Emile, who was a master painter at the École des Beaux-Arts.
Mm. I'm trying to think of my knowledge of the German occupation of Europe in World War II. France was one of the early countries to be occupied. It was occupied by the Nazis for 4 years. However, Paris was not bombed. All of the great landmarks of Paris, Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, Sacré-Cœur, all of those places remained unharmed. What about the Louvre, which is, arguably the most famous museum in the world? Did the Nazis steal any stuff out of the Louvre?
The Louvre was somewhat untouchable because the French were so in tune with their own art. I did decide in the book to take some liberty using some art from the Louvre, but basically most of the art from the Louvre was moved out, and it was secreted right out of Paris when it was known that the Nazis were going after artwork. And they literally pulled the paintings out of their frames, rolled them up, and got them out of the city.
Hmm. Were there any other major well-known museums in occupied countries that were looted?
There were, but I didn't deal with them in the book. I decided I was going to deal with the people rather than the history of the art itself. So I stuck with just the paintings that were going to flow in and out of Maury's gallery, and I worked with the history of Paris itself. Because, as you said, Paris was occupied, but there was no war in Paris.
Yes, the
Nazis...
There
were no gunshots, there was no fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Paris remained as Paris was. But war did hit Paris. There was no money. People had to close their businesses. Things just started to stand still. Everything was rationed. There was a black market for food. There was a black market for just about everything. If you needed supplies and you could afford it, I mentioned this in my book, the black market was available, but that was for a select few.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and even when the Allies, the Americans, the British, and the Canadians retook Paris, liberated Paris, it was one of the first big cities as they marched from Normandy toward Berlin. Again, all of the major landmarks were spared. That was not the case all over Europe, though. I'm thinking, William, of Monte Cassino in Italy, which was pretty much bombed to smithereens, wasn't it?
Well, the artwork in Europe was a major issue. And that's where we enter the Monuments Men, a United States organization,
mm-hmm.
Who in conjunction with the Europeans started to map out the major monuments and the major art of Europe and documented it on maps, instructing Allied forces, don't bomb in these specific areas. These are areas we need to preserve. And they were very important to the war effort.
By the way, a couple of books written about the Monuments Men and an outstanding movie. Have you had any inkling that somebody might be interested in making your book, The Storm Over Paris, into a motion picture, William?
Well, I've had some interest, and there is no deal made yet, but I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm. This book garnered five-star reviews on Amazon. It's a nail-biting tale. The Storm Over Paris. We have a few more minutes to chat with William Grubman, the author of the book. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back to pick up our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Are you looking to buy a house for the first time? At Armco Credit Union, they're known for competitive rates and low fees. But did you know their mortgage specialists will work with you every step of the way to make sure your best interests are served? Call the mortgage department at 724-284-2020 and ask them about their first-time home buyer program that allows a minimum down payment of only 3%. Don't have time to call or visit? Simply apply for a mortgage online, armcocu.com. Armco Credit Union is an equal housing opportunity and is federally insured by NCUA.
The Knock Knights wrap up the regular season this Friday night against an old foe, and WISR will be there. Hi, everyone. This is Scott Briggs inviting you to join Dave Bacon and me as Knock travels to Freeport Friday night to wrap up the regular season. We'll have all the action beginning at 6:30 as we talk with head coach Brandon Mowry. 6:45, we're live at Freeport for a 7 o'clock kickoff. Knock football here in 2019, presented in part by Slippery Rock University, Butler County District Attorney Rich Goldinger, Troy Allen Chevrolet and GMC in Slippery Rock, and Troy Allen Buick in Katanning, the law firm of Dylan McCandless, King, Coulter & Graham, Butler Health System, United Plate Glass in Butler, Kelly's Restaurant on Main Street in Saxonburg, Next Tier Bank, Dry Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, Conlon Tarker Attorneys at Law, and the John W. Thrower Cement Corporation of Saxonburg. It's Knock in Freeport this Friday night right here on WISR, WISR680.com, and as always, on the Trib Live High School Sports Network.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. We're chatting with author William Grubman about his really, really good book, The Storm Over Paris, a nail-biting tale of art theft and kidnapping and murder in World War II, Nazi-era Europe. So some of this stolen artwork, I imagine, Gearing kept for himself. Other stuff was just hidden. Is that correct, William?
Well, the rest of the artwork was being shipped out of Europe out of Paris, into Austria and Germany.
I see. Austria was the location that Hitler planned for this grand museum, because that was actually his home country, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. Mm-hmm. And you were also correct. Hermann Göring, as a collector, was siphoning off pieces for himself as well.
So without giving away your book, of course, because it's a thriller after all, your main character, Jewish art dealer Mari Rothstein, decides to try to retake some of this stolen art. How does he manage that? Does he put together a team of people, or does he do it himself, William?
He does it with the help of his son, Emil. His son, Emil, is a art student at the École des Beaux-Arts. He's a master student. And for one of his projects for acceptance to the school, he copied a painting. The painting was titled The Expulsion of Hagar, and that painting plays a major part in the story. And Mori went to his son and said, could you copy a painting quickly if I needed you to? And that discussion turned into copying several paintings that would be swapped out for the originals. Mori would give the copies back to the Germans, and he would store away the originals for safekeeping for their owners.
The Expulsion of Hagar is a famous painting still today by Caravaggio. Is that the painting that's on the cover of your book, William?
Well, that's a composition of the painting. We had to make some adjustments for the story, but yes.
So, what a terrific idea. How'd you ever come up with this, sir?
I've always wanted to write, and I've always been interested in art. I'm an avid collector. And I decided I wanted to write about art forgery because there's so much of it in the world. And I started to write a story that took place in modern-day New York. Started to work on the project. And as I was writing, I realized my story had nothing to do with New York, but I had to go back to the beginning to make the story make sense. And the beginning turned out to be Paris, World War II.
How about the art world? How was it affected by these thefts? There had to be art historians and art lovers who were just beside themselves.
Well, you have to remember, during the war, people didn't know what was going on. Communication wasn't the same then as it is now. If something happens in Paris at 9 a.m. On a Tuesday morning, at 9:01, the entire world knows about it. So communication wasn't as existent as it is now. People really didn't know what was going on with the art world. There were those, but it wasn't like today. We didn't get news updates in real time. But the art world was very concerned that this art was going to be spirited away, and where was it going to be kept, and how safe was it?
Mm-hmm.
That was a major issue for the war.
Were the thefts mainly famous paintings, or were sculptures also heisted?
It was a combination of both. Sculptures were certainly an issue, but not the same as paintings. Paintings were much more mobile.
Mm-hmm.
It was easier to throw 10 paintings into a truck than it would be to move a major stone piece.
In the film that you mentioned earlier in our conversation, Monuments Men, they find a lot of this stuff in a cave, hidden in a cave. Did that really happen too, or was that...
Well, Hollywood took some leeway with it, but yes, they did. They absolutely did.
Walter...
There are pictures on the internet of those, of that, the storage of the art, if people want to Google it.
William Grubman, the folks spent much of his corporate career in the wholesale paper industry. When he left the confines of corporate America, he and several old friends formed Act 3. Is that an acting company, William?
No, Act 3 is a singing group.
Oh, wow. And are you still together? Are you still performing?
There, two of us are still performing, yes. We do. We perform all the time.
Act 3 is the subject of an award-winning documentary film, Once Upon a Dream, which is narrated by Richard Dreyfuss. Everybody knows that. But you have been an avid student of art history for much of your life, eh?
I have been. I find art fascinating. Specifically, my passion at this moment in time is porcelain painting. I find the works that have survived for 100, 200 years on porcelain very interesting, that people have protected these pieces from damage.
And by the way, some very famous porcelain was made in Germany, too. I imagine that some of those pieces were part of these thefts.
I would think so, yes. I can't be specific because I didn't let my research go into that type of work, but certainly Dresden was in Germany.
And I think there's a Meissen, I believe, if I'm not real knowledgeable on porcelain, but I think some of that. We have a museum here in our town that has a wonderful collection of Meissen porcelain, so that's very valuable as well. Were there ever pieces, to the best of your knowledge, famous pieces that were never recovered, William Grubman?
There is some art that was not recovered from the war, and there is artwork from World War II, which are in the wrong collections at this time still. And those are just sort of the pitfalls of that time.
Yeah, we see that in the news every so often, don't we, where somebody owns a piece that the Nazis had stolen and, you know, the real owner wants it back, or the country of origin wants it back for their museum. That pops up in the news occasionally.
Exactly. And there are pieces in the Louvre that, in fact, do not belong to the Louvre collection to this day, that belong to Jewish families who have perished. They may have descendants, but they still have them on the books as not their own property.
Well, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, William Grubman, the spoils of war, because this goes back a long, long time. There are pieces in the Louvre, I believe they're called the Elgin Marbles, if I'm remembering correctly, that come from ancient Greece, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Were you forced to go to Paris to do research on this or not?
I did. I had to go to Paris a couple of times.
To
research the locations of the city.
What a hardship, huh?
Well, you know, somebody had to do it, and it was me. But interesting, it was a great city to work in because nothing really has changed that much. A few street names have changed. I had to research back to make sure my street names were correct. Things such as that, I had to make sure that we were on track. Everything in my book is real, except the story. So many of the characters that Maury's interacting in are characters from history. Even minor characters that he might meet on the street and say hello to, in fact, were real people.
Do you use real pieces of art that were stolen, or are those the figment of your imagination?
Most of the art that I discuss is real. A couple of pieces I had to invent.
Wow, I didn't realize you could do that. No legal entanglements by using real famous pieces of art, no?
No, because history is history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they were stolen, they were stolen, right?
What it is, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also kidnapping and murder in your story, so it gets pretty tense, I guess, right, midway through?
Well, it was a dog-eat-dog time, and Maury was faced with potential imprisonment and or death, and his wife was instrumental in those scenes. I won't give away the story, but it was going to be survival of the fittest.
I knew of Hitler's idea of building this grand museum in Austria. So Hitler wanted to collect art. I did not know about Hermann Göring, the Reichsmarshal. He was an art collector as well, eh?
Major collector.
Any of the other...
He had several thousand pieces in his home.
Any of the other notorious German figures whose names we would recognize involved in this?
Well, there were other people, but I decided to keep the story focused on just the two people. What I tried to do was paint Hermann Göring as a figure different than the Hermann Göring we know. We think of Hermann Göring as a brutal killer. I'm not dismissing that; he certainly was. But I tried to bring some empathy to the character and demonstrate that, in fact, there was a side of him that was very in tune to the beautiful things in life and the relationship that I could build between him and Maury Rothstein rather than the war. And I tried to take the war out of the picture when it came to those two.
Boy, if your book Storm Over Paris ever, in fact, is made into a movie, who would play Maury Rothstein? I'm trying to think. George Clooney was one of the big stars. It was actually an ensemble cast in Monuments Men. You might need that too, William.
I'm happy to have George take the part.
I guess so. The Storm Over Paris is the title of this historical fiction thriller. It's a pretty good read, I'll tell you, by William Grubman. If you're looking for him online, it's Grubman, William Grubman. And I'm assuming your book's available in independent bookstores and online, William.
That's correct.
Nice to talk with you today. You've got a good book here. Appreciate the chat.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
And you too. So long now, sir.
I know.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680. Shh.
about you. Honey, I could